The following program was paid for by Choice Benefits Agency, LLC, and Kalinka Team Consultants, LLC. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of WMTR. As always, it is advisable to consult a professional before making a major decision. It's time now for Let's Save Thousands. Here's your host for the program, Dr. Edwin Kalinka.
Today's market is certainly unique. I hear buyers saying and asking, what the heck is going on? I hear that when I bought my last house, or my parents told me that when they bought a house, it took weeks and weeks. They saw dozens of houses. They made an offer. They negotiated for 10% below asking. Well, we're in a very, very different environment. You might even describe it as uncharted waters. It's difficult to show a first-time buyer their very first house that they've looked at and have them fall in love with it and then have to try to convey, if they love that house and their gut tells them this is it, everything about this house fits your criteria, meets all your expectations, and ask them to pull the trigger. And I also explained that if they don't do it, it's most likely in the next couple of hours it could be gone. In fact, waiting for attorney review to be completed is now filled with angst. Kierkegaard, when describing angst, said it's like the feeling you have when playing chess and you got to move your piece and your opponent tells you you can't do that because you'd be in check. And then you want to span the expanse of the globe and explode. Well, that pretty much describes that feeling of waiting during attorney review. So when an agent has to tell their buyer, yes, your offer that was $25,000 over asking was a great offer, but I've been informed there have been 37 other offers and yours was in sixth place and three of the other offers were all cash and they all waived appraisals and inspections. Yep, wanting to go running and screaming the diameter of the globe and explode, it's pretty much that sense of angst. So what can we do to help? We educate. As I mentioned last week when quoting Sean Aker, his book Before Happiness, it was suggested that we work towards eliminating noise. My interpretation of that is the unwanted stimuli that continually bombards us and infiltrates our minds, both conscious and unconscious, in an attempt to emotionally hijack us. Okay. What's emotional hijacking? Well, Dr. John Pelletieri of Queen's College, who's president of the International Society for Emotional Intelligence, describes emotions as a chemical reaction in our bodies, which they themselves are neither good nor bad. In fact, these emotions have been developed to prevent us from being harmed and to encourage us to procreate. The problem occurs in our interpretations through the lenses of our beliefs and biases. In Reframing Organizations, Artistry, Choice, and Leadership, Bowman and Deal state, all of us sometimes construct our own psychic prisons and then lock ourselves in. When we don't know what to do, we do more of what we know. So what do we know? In order to move forward, we need to examine how did we get here. In this segment, I'll rely on two trusted and valued resources. Known in the real estate space, Keeping Current Matters, and Jeffrey Otto of the Otto Group. The motto of the Otto Group is to bring clarity to real estate. They offer real estate valuations, real estate coaching, advisory, dispute and litigation support, as well as real estate economics and demography, programs in real estate stigma and benefits, as well as events and workshops. With their permission, I will share some of their findings from their recent spring workshop where Jeffrey Otto presented the spring housing market webinar examining economic assessment, suburban housing trifecta, housing market dynamics and valuation issues, as well as a housing forecast. In his economic assessment, Otto started with the comparison of the global COVID impact with a slide from Johns Hopkins. It indicates that Chechnya, with a population of over 10,700,000, had the highest death rate per thousand in the world at 2.2. In the United States, we ranked fifth highest with a population of 328,564,000 deaths, with a death rate of 1.7 per thousand. When examining the population of COVID deaths in New Jersey and New York, we find that New York has a population of 19 million plus, now with over 50,000 deaths, with a death rate of 2.6 thousand, which is higher than 2.5 indicated by the Johns Hopkins data used to construct the table in its presentation, and both of those being higher than Chechnya. I want to make it clear that that was my calculation sought from the current statistics for New York City from Population USA, which indicates New York City has a population of 8.5 million. Choi, Velasquez, and Welch reported on April 14th that New York City has a death toll of 31,957. When we divide that death toll by the population, that gives us an astounding statistic that New York City has a death rate of 3.76 per thousand, which is significantly higher than any country in the world. These statistics, highlight the negative impact on New York City and New Jersey. It's also notable that Little Rhode Island, with a population of over a million, was third on that list with a death rate of 2.4 per thousand of the population. Once again, this is all from the New York City metropolitan area, which is densely populated. See, we recognize the significant difference between the death rates of Chechnya being the country with the highest death rate with 2.2 per thousand compared to New Jersey with a death rate of 2.7. Then looking at all of this compared to New York City with a death rate of 3.7 per thousand, it's understandable that the term used for the exodus of densely populated city has been coined urban flight. Laying the groundwork to compare our current housing situation with what he later would compare to the 2006 housing bubble as a means of allaying any fears, Otto examines unemployment losses. From the end of March to a year ago, April 20th, 2020, there was a historic loss of jobs, over 22 million. Accordingly, in the same period, we saw the worst period ever for initial unemployment claims, with over 6.8 million nationally and over 214,000 here in New Jersey. By comparison, today, initial unemployment claims are down to about 9,400 in New Jersey. When looking at hospitalizations for COVID-19 in New Jersey, they skyrocketed in April 2020 with over 8,000, whereas March 4th of 2021, they were around 2,100. This is a marked positive improvement. Otto believes we'll have continued improvement as more and more people are being vaccinated and we grow ever mindful that the proper protocols needed to prevent the spread of this disease. This, of course, is dependent upon that unknown variable, human behavior. In order to gain greater perspective in what is contributing to this housing market, Otto examined interest rates. The prime rate in January 2020 was 1.33%. Now it's dropped to 0.07% as of March 21st. The interest rates for residential mortgages varied based on types of loan. When examining the 5-1 ARM, the 15-year fix, and the 30-year fix, the following comparisons were noted. In January 2020, the 30-year was at 3.72%, and it's currently down to 3.09%. In January 2020, the 15-year was at 3.5%, and it's now 2.79%. The 5-1 ARM was at 3.16 in January 2020. In March of 2021, it was down at 2.4. These rates reflect the Fed's effort to stimulate the economic recovery. Otto went on to examine home buying power and how, even though home prices have soared over 12% in the past year, you can buy that property paying a higher price and still be paying less. No, we're not talking about smoke and mirrors here. As Sergeant Joe Friday would say, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. He illustrated how a buyer with an income of $100,000 would have a housing budget of $2,500, would have qualified to purchase a home just under $350,000 as of April 1st in 2020. That same $2,500 today would buy a property for $368,000, an increase of about 5.4% in buying power. Otto described the housing trifecta. We've already discussed COVID and New York City's impact on urban flight. What he found was all densely populated cities throughout the United States are experiencing the same phenomenon, being fueled by urban flight combined with telework. The amazing and historic low interest rates combined with millennials reaching home buying age. This has produced a suburban boom, with buyers looking for less density, larger spaces, personal control. Buyers are looking for open floor plans, bigger pantries, larger closets, and outdoor amenities. However, the trend may not continue. With rental rates being reduced in New York City and interest rates possibly crawling up, this will likely lead to a slight correction in a couple of years. Otto points out that New Jersey's 1.8 millennials accounted for 72% of the home buying. The housing market in 2020 showed an increase of 11% in the number of sales. The dramatic rise in sales in 2020 has now left a remarkable shortage in inventory, and the year-over-year comparisons indicate this. To give some context, in the years from 2013 to 2016, the unsold inventory in each March was approximately 49,000. Those numbers gradually dropped to about 41,600 in 2017. However, in 2020, they were 28,113. By comparison, in the first quarter of 2021, the unsold inventory dropped to 15,492, less than a third of what it was in March of 2016, and 50% less of what the inventory was in 2020. These are historically low numbers of listings available. This is happening nationwide and impacts the supply and demand relationship. Otto calculated to date, sales are up by 9%. However, last year we were quarantining. The sale contracts through the balance of 2020 from June through December showed record increases in volume. I believe this is in part due to that pent-up desire of people wanting to buy during that quarantining period, making the move during the balance of the year, which increased those numbers. What is remarkable is the change in home sales and unsold inventory when viewed by price category. Let's take a look at this. Homes less than $400,000 this year have dropped by 10%. While unsold inventory has dropped by 50%. I personally have to wonder if this isn't due in part to the 11 to 12% increase in value, which put them over that $400,000 threshold. Homes between $400 and $599 have an increase in the year-to-date contracts, but a drop in inventory of 43%. Homes between $600,000 and $1 million. Although contracts have increased by 50% this year, inventory is down by 43%. Homes between $1 million and $2.5 million are up an astounding 91%, while inventory is down 28%. And homes over $2.5 million have seen an increase in number of contracts by 87%, with a drop in inventory by 13%. In real estate, we examine what is referred to as absorption rate, or months of supply. In a balanced market, it's normally to have 6 months supply or 7 months supply for a balanced inventory. So when there's more than 6 months inventory, it's referred to as a buyer's market because there are more homes to choose from and they're on the market longer. So when there's more than 6 months inventory, it's referred to as a buyer's market because there are more homes to choose from and they're on the market longer. When we have less than 6 months supply and there's less inventory, it's a seller's market. When it's a buyer's market, there's a wider room for negotiations and the homes sell for a little less than asking price. In the seller's market, we're seeing homes selling in less than 3 weeks now, often having bidding wars with homes selling tens of thousands above asking. When we have these shifts, Otto indicates that we have a 7 month supply of inventory that indicates stability. With a 1 month supply of inventory, he predicts 0.5% increase in value on a monthly basis. When we have 3 months supply, we see an increase of 0.25% per month in value. Conversely, when we have 12 months supply, we can anticipate 0.25% per month decrease in equity and sales price. And with a 24 month supply of inventory, there very well could be 0.5% per month drop in equity and sales prices. Separating some of the New Jersey towns by lowest and highest amount of inventory, we find that Logan Township has the lowest amount of inventory with 0.7 months availability or absorption. Maywood has 1.2 months of inventory available. Lyndhurst with 1.3 months and Manville with 1.3 months inventory as well. Towns with the highest inventory are Union City with 4.9 months, Bernardsville Borough with 5.2, Edgewater Borough meets the stability threshold at 7 months, with three towns, including Saddle River and Alpine, which have 8.3 and 12.1 months of inventory available. This remarkable market with values jumping has made it difficult to keep up with valuations. I can share that as a real estate broker, when a property is examined by a realtor for the purpose of a market analysis, or when an appraiser establishes value for a lending institution, it's required that the subject property be compared to what's called comparable properties, things of like and similar kinds. And that means we're comparing apples to apples. In this case, homes of similar style, condition, similar locations and developments. Otto's provided what would be called an adjustment guide. You know, the property we're examining for the purpose of establishing value is referred to as the subject property. An appraiser would examine similar homes that are for sale, under contract, and recent sales. Recent sales are to be no older than 6 months. A common occurrence of late has been when buyers in a bidding war win the contract, but the property fails to make value. That may require a negotiation, and in some cases, the buyer can request that it be examined or contest that appraisal. However, they may not be in their best interest. A response in the appraisal industry is now to examine those comparable sales, see how many months ago they took place, and add 1% value per month since that closed. So for example, if a property sold for $500,000 4 months ago, an appraiser finds that the sale is a valid comparable, he or she can make an adjustment to that comparable property and up the value by $20,000. When consulting with clients prior to taking a listing, we go over the comparable sales. Not all homes are the same. In order to level the playing field, we speak in a matrix of adjustments are considered. Those items to be considered are location. You've heard location, location, location. This would compare the site location. You know, let's say if it's on a busy road, today a home of $250,000 would see a drop of about 2.4%. The higher the price increase, so let's say we go to $750,000, you're more likely to see a reduction of about $4.7 or $35,000. And that goes even higher when it's in the luxury market. Other location and site items include being situated near power lines, the amount of acreage. You know, property improvements are considered as well as quality construction, the materials, the craftsmanship. They all make a difference. And age is a factor. The interior condition and decor matter as well. The number of bathrooms renovations, new kitchens, baths being updated, the gross square footage, these all play into that matrix. Does it have a basement? Is it a partial basement? Is it a crawl space? You know, is the basement finished? Heating and fuel type matter. Number of zones matter. The garage, is it attached, detached? What type of amenities does the garage have? Is it heated? Does it have extra storage? Exterior items like decks, porches, patios, and in-ground pools are calculated in the equation. And today, even special energy-saving items are factored in. Otto emphasizes that homes that are priced at the fair market value will sell best. When a property is priced above market value, the seller loses and it will spend more time on the market. He contends that pricing a home at fair market value today, you will see above asking prices of about $19,000 when the house is selling between $300,000 and $500,000. When you're asking up to $1 million, you're looking at increases of property offers of over $40,000. A concern today is that there are a number of pundits forecasting gloom and doom for the real estate industry. The bubble is coming. The bubble is coming. I will admit that I was worried with the number of mortgages and forbearance due to COVID pandemic. I've had conversations with attorneys who specialize in handling bank foreclosures, and they would tell me that the number of filings has steadily climbed, and they are truly concerned. And that concern transferred to me as I was internally looking to see if the sky was falling. However, my view was limited to my past experiences, my beliefs and biases. Honestly, Otto alleviated my fears by sharing his housing forecast, where he explained it was extremely bright. Although we've reached the record number of houses sold and increases in value parallel to 2006, that's where the comparison stops. We'll revisit that in a moment. First, he pointed out the economy is going to continue to open up. Interest rates will remain low. Millennials will continue to buy homes. Inventory will increase. People will come out and start to trade up in buying. Otto sees the market staying strong for at least the next 2 years. And people will get vaccinated, will learn how to live with COVID-19, and the listing supply will increase. Prices will continue to rise, but at a slower pace, and vacation market will boom because they are the new Zoom market. He cautions us to be mindful that this virus will never completely disappear, that urban flight from New York City will slow as the economy recovers. Foreclosures may become an issue down the road, but right now there's no need for immediate fear. He compared the state and national mortgage delinquencies from 2013 to 2020 and now. In 2013, the national 90-day plus day delinquency rate for the United States was 6.3%. In New Jersey, by comparison, during that same time period, it was 11.8%. And I will share that New Jersey became the leading foreclosure state in the nation. In 2020, the national rate of delinquencies was 1.2%, while in New Jersey, it was 1.9%. Currently, the U.S. rate for delinquencies is 3.9%, and that's 2.4% less than the 6.3% in 2013. Examining the current delinquency rate in New Jersey at 5.4%, that is 6.4% less than it was in 2000. Let's look at it another way. The U.S. rate for delinquencies is 31% less than it was in 2013. In New Jersey, it shows that the delinquency rates are 54% less. Alleviating any fear is the unemployment projections, which continue to show promise and will continue to improve. Otto projects that we will see a raise in values of 8% in 2021 and continue with another 3% in 2022 and a possible correction of maybe 2 to 4% in 2023. A major concern has been product scarcity and rising prices. Although tariff policy had played a part, a greater concern is the impact on the supply chain wrought by COVID-19. I've had a number of conversations with contractors and supply houses in the past couple of years, and everyone clamoring about not having enough supplies. But Otto gave me a new understanding why that 2x4, which cost about $3 a few years ago, is now hedging $8. He went on to discuss the devastation of the repeated forest fires we've suffered in the last several years and how it's impacted our lumber supply, having been taken a major hit. Honestly, you can't grow a 2x4 overnight. It takes 7 to 8 years to grow a Douglas fir suitable for a Christmas tree. It takes 50 years to grow a timber for lumber. I thank the Otto Group, a real estate valuation and advisory company, for allowing me to share their data. I encourage you to go to otto.com. That's OTTEAU.com. Visit their website and consider signing up for their market track and workshops in their continued effort to bring clarity to real estate.
Hi, my name is Dr. Edwin Kalinka, broker associate with Keller Williams Metropolitan. The Kalinka team brings a unique level of expertise, including building, mortgages, municipal land use, and insurance, all put to use in representing our clients. Contact us for a free buyer or seller's guide. For more information, visit our website at kalinkateam.com or call us at 844-KALINKA, 844-525-4652.
In May, the CDC quoted Dr. Patsanis that what worried him most about a post-pandemic condition was mental health. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres stated that unless we act now to address mental health needs associated with the pandemic, there will be long-term consequences for families, communities, and society. Well, 6 months ago seems like a lifetime ago. Much has changed in these tragic months. However, it seems more than humans' mental health has been impacted. Our pets have been impacted as well, especially dogs. We're here with our guest, Stacy Royal of Royal Canine Dog Training. Stacy has over 30 years' experience specializing in dog training and dog behavior. Stacy, welcome to Let's Save Thousands. Stacy, please tell us about this phenomenon
impacting our dog.
Thanks, Ed. Well, one of the biggest things that I see has to do with the fact that many people did go out and adopt or buy puppies, which is a fantastic thing. They have some extra time at home. They wanted to, you know, give that time to a pet in need. And one of the downsides to that is that because we're home all the time and we're not leaving, sometimes people are, without realizing it, developing some unhealthy bonding and relationships with their dogs. Mainly, I'm talking about separation anxiety. So I get the calls when there are behavioral issues. Someone has a young puppy, wants to do some training. Something I am seeing so much of now, which is very, very sad, is separation anxiety. There are varying degrees of separation anxiety. It can just be some minor protests that a dog just maybe doesn't want you to leave. Or it could become very severe where dogs are actually harming themselves, you know, physically biting on crates, bloodying their paws, trying to escape, frantic behavior, you know, rapid heartbeat. The thing about separation anxiety is that we humans have such an impact on it that it really is up to us to try to prevent it and to work on trying to cure it if this should become an issue.
What actions can pet owners take in order to help alleviate those symptoms?
So they might be, they're going to be different depending on how severe the symptoms are. So if you take a dog that has separation anxiety, of course, if it's an extreme case, you need to see a veterinarian and you may need to have some help through medication to help to calm and relax the dog. The medication is absolutely not a cure-all or a quick fix. The idea behind medication, if it's extreme enough to warrant medication, is that it can kind of relax the dog so that the behavior modification and the training can start to take place. So what needs to be done is there are different things that we work on. Sometimes it's working on our cues that we do before we leave to go somewhere. It's wintertime. Most of us put on a coat. Some of us grab a bag or a hat or gloves or a pocketbook. We pick up our keys. And the dogs take notice of that from a very young age, and they know those signs mean that you're leaving. So if the case is kind of severe, it might be as simple as working on giving those cues throughout the day when you're not actually going anywhere, so that you're kind of desensitizing the dog to not think, oh my gosh, keys are picked up, I'm losing my owner. You don't want them to think that. You want them to think that keys being picked up and put down is no big deal, coat on, coat off. You have to also work up to cues of how you behave when you come and when you go. The worst thing to do is to have a big long goodbye, as well as coming in and having a big excited hello because everybody's missed each other so much. You want to absolutely downplay all comings and goings. I mean, at most, you know, just a simple, you know, see ya, turn around, leave, don't look back. Now, the problem is when does the separation anxiety start? How long does it last? So, of course, there's going to be different protocols based on the severity and some of those things that I just mentioned. But sometimes, you know, it's as simple as you need to just get up, grab your keys, and go from one room to the next room, and then return before the dog starts to fuss, if possible. If the dog fusses, we want to ignore, right? We just kind of leave, come back in, don't look at the dog, don't talk to the dog. You're trying to say, hey, this is kind of a normal situation. Sometimes I need to go places. I leave, I return, it's no big deal. I'm not making a big fuss over you. So I want to set the example so that you kind of follow my lead. If you're able to, then the cues need to actually go to, you know, everything on, coat on, keys, pocketbook, hat, whatever. Leave the door, you know, the front door, the back door, whichever door you normally go through, and can you leave and return before the fussing or the protesting starts? We start to work on making the leaving longer and longer and longer. And when I say longer, 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 it might be stretching it out by a matter of seconds. I'm not talking about you start with 5 minutes and you just hop right up to an hour. You've got to do it kind of gradually because we're trying to keep a stable frame of mind for the dog so that this does not become such a big deal. So when the separation anxiety is there, of course, this is a difficult, slow and steady kind of wins the race to get beyond this. Sometimes it's a matter of working with the crate if you haven't been working with the crate. If it's a newer dog, I tell all of my clients, I am seeing still loads of puppies people are getting from COVID, which is great because that helps our mental health. You know, it's nice that we can have something that reduces blood pressure and a companion and something to focus on and, you know, something bright in this time that can be a little bit challenging for all of us. But we need to do right by the dogs because our job is to make sure that we set them up to be stable-minded and healthy-minded for the rest of their lives. So I talk to people with young puppies about, hey, you need to have some discipline. Even though you don't leave the house, you still need to put your dog, you know, let's say in a crate or in another room from time to time, various times throughout the day, so the dog learns that it's no big deal. And that way you're starting to prepare for a situation where you may be actually someday returning to work where you have to leave the house. And now your dog is going to be much, much better off.
Stacy, how can our listeners get a hold of you either by your website or what resources would you point them to find out more information about this?
The website is great, www.royalk9, and that's the letter K, the number 9.com. You know, somebody can call me if they want to call me, 201-207-5342. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, these dogs need our help, and you know, we kind of owe it to them to keep them happy and mentally healthy. You know, it's our job because, you know, they're helping us out, so we need to help them in return.
Stacy, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ed. I appreciate it.
I now want to welcome Beverly Kalinka, managing broker of Keller Williams Metropolitan and valued member of the Kalinka team. Beverly, what are some of the things you'd like to talk about today?
It's great to be here this morning at Let's Save Thousands. I wanted to talk about the luxury market and how it's attracting buyers in 2020. As more people continue to identify their changing needs this year, some are turning to the upscale housing sector for more space and finer features. In the most recent luxury market report, the Institute for Luxury Home Marketing, and that's the ILHM, shares the following, and I quote, "In a snapshot of 2020, despite the devastating effects of the coronavirus pandemic, the luxury real estate market has seen one of its strongest years since 2008. In comparison to experts' predictions in early 2020, it is remarkable how significant demands for property type, location, and amenity preferences have changed amid the pandemic. So with more opportunities to work from home and a growing interest to have more extra space for things like virtual school, working out, cooking more meals, the desire to own a home that can meet the needs continues to increase. Additionally, the record low mortgage rates are creating opportunities for home buyers to stretch their legs into higher price points and even expand their real estate portfolio." The ILHM reports as follows, and I quote, "Experts believe that the demand for exclusive residential properties outside the metropolitan area will continue well into 2021. Even with the introduction of vaccines, the pandemic is far from over. For those who have moved to the suburbs and beyond, moving back to the city full-time is unlikely while the work-from-home trend remains. Many of these affluent homeowners are now making their secondary properties their primary residence. So if you're interested in buying a home this year, it appears that some of the higher price markets may have more inventory to choose from than the lower price points." The director of economic research at Realtor.com states, and I quote, "Interestingly, markets where new supply is improving the fastest tend to be the higher priced than those that have yet to see improvement, suggesting sellers are more active in the more expensive markets." The bottom line to all of this is if you're hoping to buy the house of your dreams, this could be the year to achieve that goal. So Ed, the next thing I wanted to chat about was something I read in Keeping Current Manners. Should you buy a retirement home sooner rather than later? And I think some of the statistics that were in this article were pretty remarkable. Every day in the United States, roughly 10,000 people turn 65, prior to the health crisis that swept the nation in 2020. Most people had to wait until they retired to make a move to the beach, to the golf course, or to that senior living community where they were looking to settle in for the later years. This year, however, was a game changer. Many of today's workers are still nearing the end of their professional careers, but maybe they're not quite ready to retire and have a new choice. Should I make the move before I retire? And if the sand and sun are calling your name and you have the opportunity to work remotely for the foreseeable future, now may be a great time to purchase that beach bungalow that you've always dreamed of, or the ranch, the sprawling ranch by the lake in a countryside. Whether it's a second home or a future retirement home, spending the next few years in a place that truly makes you smile every day may be the best way to round out a long and meaningful career. The chief economist for the National Association of Realtors explains, and I quote, "The pandemic was unexpected. Working from home was unexpected, but nonetheless, many companies realize that workers can be just as productive working from home. We may begin to see a boost in people buying retirement homes before their retirement." So according to the 20th annual Transamerican Retirement Survey, 3 out of 4 retirees, that's 75%, own their homes, and only 23% have mortgage debt, including any equity loans or lines of credit. Since entering retirement, 4 out of 10 retirees, 38%, have moved into new homes. They're making a profit by selling their current home in today's low inventory market and using their equity to purchase their future retirement. I mean, it's a win-win. So why these homeowners are making the moves now, here's the reason. The health crisis this year made us all much more aware of the importance of family and friends. And many of us have not seen our extended family since the pandemic started. So it's no surprise to see the same report that 32% of those surveyed cited the top reason they're making a move is that they wanted to be closer to family and friends. The survey also revealed that 73% of retirees currently live in single-family homes, with the overall number of homes for sale today hitting a historic low, and with buyer demand for single-family homes skyrocketing, there's never been a more ideal time to sell your single-family home and make the move towards retirement. Today's market has the perfect combination of driving forces that make selling optimal, and especially why buyers are looking to take advantage of low interest rates. Again, it's a win-win. So if you're one of the 73% of retirees with a single family home and want to move closer to your family, now is a great time to put your house on the market. With the pace of home selling today, you can essentially wrap up your move start to finish before the holidays. Bottom line, whether you're looking to fully retire or buy a second home with the intent to use it as your retirement home in the future, the 2020 fall housing market and the 2021 spring market may very well work in your favor. Hey, Ed, let's have a little bit of fun. I've got the 2021 Mythbusters, which are the 5 common misconceptions about today's competitive real estate market. Drum roll for number one. Myth number one: it's better to get pre-approved after you find the perfect home to buy. Reality is you should get pre-approved before you begin your home search so that you know your budget and that you can act quickly and be ready to make an offer. It just makes you stronger, look stronger to the seller. Makes sense. Myth number two: always start with your lowest offer when buying a home. Not in today's market. Reality, in a competitive market like we have today, you may not get a second chance. It is a seller's market, people. Until the inventory levels out a little bit more, it's a seller's market. Myth number three: is it better to price your house on the high side when you're selling? Okay, reality, a house that's priced competitively will likely sell faster and attract multiple offers. Myth number four, renovating your house will definitely net you more money when you sell. Well, this is a double-edged sword, and this is where you really want to give us a call. The reality is some renovations may be necessary, but not all of them. Get your agent to advise you on what's important before you go to sell, before you spend the money to fix something. So just to go off on a quick tangent, you know, coat of paint is always makes the world of difference. If your kitchen is dated, your bathrooms are dated, but everything is in good condition, and I mean good condition, sometimes it's not worth trying to put in that extra $20,000, $40,000, $50,000. You won't net it at the end. But again, that's on an individual basis. So, and it might be you don't want to go through that particular work. I mean, you know, getting a new bathroom, getting a new kitchen, so on, can take a lot of time and expense. So call us on that. We're good at that. Myth number five. It's safe to skip the home inspection if the house looks good. That's a double Reality is you should never skip your home inspection. If you uncover, you can uncover hidden problems that could end up costing you an absolute fortune. So Ed, those are the 2021 Mythbusters in real estate. I thought that was great.
Beverly, thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Dr. Edwin Kalinka, broker associate with Keller Williams Metropolitan. The Kalinka team brings you a unique level of expertise, including building, mortgages, municipal land use, and insurance, all put to use in representing our clients. Contact us for a free buyer or seller's guide. For more information, visit our website at kalinkateam.com or call us at 844-KALINKA, 844-525-4652.
Next, I'd like to share four major reasons households in forbearance won't lose their homes to foreclosure. There's been a lot of discussion as to what will happen once the 2.3 million households currently in forbearance no longer have the protection of the program. Some assume there could be potentially being millions of foreclosures ready to hit the market. However, there are four reasons why it won't happen. Number one, almost 50% leave forbearance already caught up in their payments. Number one, almost 50% have left forbearance already having caught up in their payments. According to Mortgage Bankers Association data, through March 28th, it shows that 48.9% of homeowners who have already left the program were current on their mortgage payments when they exited. 26.6% made their monthly payments during the forbearance period. 14.7% brought past due payments current, and 7.6% paid off their loan in full. This doesn't mean that over 2 million still in the plan will exactly end the same way. It does, however, give us some insight into the possibilities. Number two, the banks don't want to buy them. Number two, the banks don't want the house back. Banks have learned lessons from the crash of 2008. Lending institutions don't want the headaches of managing foreclosed properties. This time, they're working with homeowners to help them save their homes. An example? About 50% of all mortgages are backed by the Federal Housing Finance Agency. In 2008, the FHFA offered 208,000 homeowners some form of home retention action, which are options offered to a buyer who have the financial ability to enter a workout option and want to stay in their homes. Home retention options include temporary forbearances, repayment plans, loan modifications, or partial loan deferrals. These help delinquent borrowers stay in their homes. Over the past year, the FHFA has offered that same protection to over 1 million homeowners. Today, almost all lending institutions are working with their borrowers. The report from the MBA reveals that those homeowners who have left forbearance, 35.5% have worked out a repayment plan with their lender, 26.5% granted a loan deferral where a borrower does not have to pay the lender interest or principal on a loan for an agreed amount of time, and 9% were given loan modifications. Number three, there's no political will to foreclose on these households. The government also seems determined not to let individuals or families lose their homes. Bloomberg recently reported mortgage companies could face penalties if they don't take steps to prevent a deluge of foreclosures that threatens to hit the housing market later this year. A U.S. regulator said the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, warning is tied to forbearance relief that's allowed millions of borrowers to delay their mortgage payments due to the pandemic. Mortgage servicers should start reaching out to affected homeowners now to advise them on ways they can modify their loans. The CFPB is proposing a new set of guidelines to ensure people will be able to retain their homes. Here are the major points in the proposal. The proposed rule would provide a special pre-foreclosure review period that would generally prohibit servicers from starting a foreclosure until after December 31, 2021. Secondly, the proposed rule would permit servicers to offer certain streamlined loan modification options to borrowers with COVID-19-related hardships based on an evaluation of an incomplete application. The proposal rule wants temporary changes to certain required servicer communications to make sure borrowers receive key information about their options at the appropriate time. A final decision is yet to be made, and some do question whether the CFPB has the power to delay foreclosures. The entire report can be found at the Protections for Borrowers Affected by COVID-19 Emergency under the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, Regulation X. And fourth, if all else fails, homeowners will sell their homes before a foreclosure. Homeowners have a record level of equity today. According to the latest CoreLogic Home Equity Report, the average equity of mortgaged homes is currently $204,000. 38% of the homes do not have a mortgage, so the level of equity available to today's homeowners is quite significant. Just like the banks, homeowners learned a lesson from the housing crash too. In the same way that grandparents and great-grandparents were shaped by the Great Depression, much of the public today remembers the 2006 mortgage meltdown and the foreclosures, unemployment, and bank failures it created. No one with any sense wants to repeat that experience, and it may explain why so much real estate equity remains mortgage-free. What does that mean to the forbearance situation? According to Black Knight, just 1 in 10 homeowners in forbearance has less than 10% equity in their home, typically the minimum necessary to be able to sell through traditional real estate channels to avoid foreclosure. So what's the bottom line? The reports of massive foreclosures about to come to the market are highly exaggerated. As Ivy Zelman, Chief Executive Officer of Zelman & Associates, with roughly 30 years of experience covering housing and housing-related industries, recently proclaimed, the likelihood of us having a foreclosure crisis is about zero. So, cutting through all the noise, the question is owning a home a good investment? Well, 93% of Americans believe a home is a better investment than stocks. A recent survey of consumer finances study by the Federal Reserve reveals the net worth of homeowners is 40 times greater than that of renters. If you're wondering if home ownership is a good investment, the study clearly answers that question, and the answer is yes. Do Americans believe a home is a better investment than stocks? In a post in the Liberty Street Economics blog, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York notes that 93.3% of Americans believe buying a home is definitely or probably a better investment than buying stocks. Here's how the results broke down. The question was, is buying a home or buying stocks a better investment? 39.5% said probably. 53.8% said definitely. Those who were in favor of stocks, 4.8% said definitely, and 1.9% said probably. The survey also shows a wide range of reasons why Americans feel that way. Respondents were able to pick more than one answer. Reasons why a home is a better investment than stocks, housing prices are less volatile, were acknowledged by 55.7%. Desired living environment provides stability, 53.9%. Tax reasons, 47.5%. Saving from rent sufficient to cover costs, 43.9%. Leverage, 43.3%. Higher housing returns, 38%. Commitment device, 33.8%. Locks in housing cost, 28.8%. The bottom line is the data shows how strongly Americans believe in home ownership as an investment. That belief is warranted. The Liberty Street Economics blog put it best by saying, housing represents the largest asset owned by most households and is a major means of wealth accumulation, particularly for the middle class. Adding to the data pointing towards a brighter economy is taxable equity. That's the amount available for homeowners to access before hitting a maximum 80% loan to value. Freddie Mac marks the 30-year fixed rate at 3.17% as of March 4, 2021, which has risen from a record low point in January, having dropped below 3%. Sam Catter, chief economist at Freddie Mac, states that during the course of the pandemic, home has become more important than ever. As a result, strong purchase demands continue, but buyers outnumber sellers. Since January, mortgage rates have increased 0.5% from historic lows, and home prices have risen, leaving potential home buyers with less purchasing power. Unfortunately, this has affected the low end of the market where supply is the slimmest. In 2020, the tappable equity of mortgage holders in the United States has risen to an all-time high of over $7 trillion as per Black Knight, while in 2006, it was valued at $4.6 trillion. Comparing the percentages of cash-out refis in 2006 to 2020, we see that in 2006, 89% were cash-out refis versus 33% in 2020. Cash-out refis spiked in 2020 to their highest point since the financial crisis. In 2006, home equity cash-out refinances rose to $321 billion before the crash. In 2020, cash-out refinances topped only $153 billion, less than half. A comparative examination of the percentage of tappable equity refinanced shows that 7% of home equity was tapped in 2006, while only 2% in 2020, as per Black Knight, Freddie Mac, and KCM Research. Again, reinforcing that during this pandemic in 2020, it's been nothing like 2006. Wall Street Journal reports the residential real estate market is on its biggest tear since 2006, just before the housing bubble burst and set off a global recession. Yet in nearly every meaningful way, today's market is the inverse of the previous boom. In the mid-2000s, loose mortgage lending standards enabled borrowers with poor credit histories to purchase homes beyond their means, sometimes with mortgages that required low payments in the very early years. To add more sunshine to this bright prognostication, let's examine CoreLogic's Home Equity Insights data through the fourth quarter of 2020. Negative equity is referred to as being underwater or upside down. This applies to borrowers who owe more on their mortgages than their homes are worth. Negative equity can occur because of a decline in home value and an increase in mortgage debt, or both. This data includes properties with a mortgage and does not calculate the approximate 38% of residential properties which are owned outright. That source is from 2016 American Community Survey. The CoreLogic analysis shows U.S. homeowners with mortgages is roughly 62%. They saw their equity increase by a total of $1.5 trillion since the first quarter of 2019, an increase 16.2% year over year. Negative equity fell the fourth quarter of 2020 as the total number of residential properties with negative equity decreased from the third quarter in 2020. And that translated to 1.5 million homeowners, or 2.8% of all mortgage properties. On the year-over-year basis, negative equity fell by 21% from 1.9 million homes, or 3.6% of all mortgage properties in the fourth quarter of 2019. Home equity is affected by home price changes. Borrowers with equity positions plus or minus 5%, the negative equity cutoff, are more likely to move out of or into negative equity as price changes, respectively. Examining the fourth quarter of 2020, the book of mortgages, if
if home prices increase by 5%, 216,000 homes would regain equity. If prices decline by 5%, 292,000 would fall underwater. CoreLogic states, as competition for the dwindling supply of for-sale homes drove up pricing, the average annual home equity gains in the fourth quarter 2020 reached the highest level since 2013. This has created a buffer against financial difficulties brought on by the pandemic and enabled the means for pursuing renovations as people are spending more time at home. For the broader market, home equity gains have also reduced the risk of homes falling underwater and pushing distressed sales into the market. Chief economist for CoreLogic, Frank Nothaft, states, compared with the year earlier, home prices in December 2020 were up sharply, 9.2% according to CoreLogic Home Price Index, boosting the amount of home equity for the average homeowner with a mortgage to more than $200,000. This equity growth has enabled many families to finance remodeling, such as an office, study, further contributing to last year's record level in home improvement spending. CoreLogic contends that the average homeowner gained approximately $26,300 in equity in the past year. California, Idaho, and Washington were with the highest gains of $54,500, $48,500, and $47,200, respectively. North Dakota had the lowest average equity gain in the fourth quarter of 2020 with $7,900. New York was shown to have a $25,000 gain in equity growth, while New Jerseyan homeowners had their equity grow on an average of $33,000. For more from CoreLogic, go to CoreLogic.com. I hope Beverly and I have brought you some insights into the real estate market and helped you with some tips, armed you with some positive stats and talking points. When you're thinking real estate, let's save thousands. Before we go, I want to give a shout out to all the Interactors and Rotarians who participated in last week's End Hunger 3.6 program that procured and distributed 150,000 meals from the Madison First Aid parking lot. When we think of a bright future, these high school Interact students light up the day for so many. I want to thank every student, their parents, and all the Rotarians who helped. Interested in finding out more about Rotary in your area? Go to njrotary.org. We thank you for investing your time with us. Come join us next week here on WMTR at 12:50 a.m. for another episode of Let's Save Thousands.
The preceding program was paid for by Choice Benefits Agency, LLC, and Kalinka Team Consultants, LLC. The views and opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the staff and management of WMTR. As always, it is advisable to consult a professional before making a major decision.